Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. What you heard there under us coming in was Max Roach, snare drum, one of our great artists and radical revolutionary thinkers and composers and musicians. Max Roach, who died on this day in 2007, honoring some of us this day with some of his music. On our way to continue our conversation, I want to remind you this program has brought you in part, the Mark Steiner Show has brought you in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal, and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's National Foreclosure Settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555. We continue our conversation here. Jossie Ross has remained with us, as we introduced last time, member of the Blackfoot Tribe Nation. He's a father, writer, entrepreneur, attorney, currently practices law representing tribes for the Crowell Law Office's Tribal Advocacy Group, author of the book Don't Know Much About Indians, which is a very interesting and funny book. We are also joined by Mark Trahant, who has written books like The Last Great Battle of Indian Wars, Henry M. Jackson, Forrest J. Gerard, and the Campaign for the Self-Determination of American Indians, and Pictures of Our Nobler Selves, and is the Atwood Journalism Chair at the University of Alaska Anchorage, and an independent print and broadcast journalist who has been on the show before. And Jossie, thanks for staying with us, and Mark Trahant, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Good morning.
Good morning. 410-31, and these, you all are out west, right? So yeah, it really is morning.
It's early.
It's early.
And the number. Well, I'm on Central Time. I'm in South Dakota, it's pretty early.
410. We appreciate it. 410-319-8888. And before we jump into kind of the broader news issues we're going to talk about with the two of you, I want to go to the call from our last conversation as we were talking with Jossie Ross about what's going on in the Native community, especially vis-a-vis reactions to Trayvon Martin. And let's get a call about that, and it'll help us jump off this conversation as well. 410-319-8888. Robert in the county are on the air.
Okay, thank you, Mark. Yes, basically what all I really want to say is this, the fact that, you know, I really do wish there were a stronger coalition between people of color. I mean, I know that there was one established between African Americans and those of Jewish population. I think it was called the Blues. But I really do wish that there was a stronger coalition between people of color. I think now, more than ever, we need those coalitions. So many times, protests go on where it says there's one distinct populace, one particular demographic, pretty much protesting against the mainstream, and too often, other communities of color don't seem to contribute to the effort. My other point I want to make is the fact that, you know, you mentioned something about foundational law earlier, a few minutes ago before the break.
Yeah.
But I want to kind of talk about the informal foundational law, which is basically the one that I think has been an establishment since the very inception of the country, which is basically that when you get right down to it, no one's addressed this huge elephant in the room. That basically, from a Eurocentric point of view, is that the lives of people of color just don't matter as much. No one's saying that, and I realize that we can't. It's not codified. I know that that's not something that's really measurable. But when you get right down to it, it's so obvious. And yet, when we say something like that, that sounds so trite, you know, it's easy to dismiss. But no one's really getting to the underpinnings of the fact that all these laws, whether it be the fact that a young African-American child who's leaving the store, completely unarmed, can be basically murdered right down the street and still the perpetrator walk away without any significant charges. We don't seem to have the will to recognize the fact that the lives of people of color just aren't viewed as being as important as those of a Eurocentric background. That's all I have to say. And one more thing I want to say. Am I still on?
Yes, you are, Robert.
And I want to say one more thing, and I know I'm going to butcher this quote because I can't remember the person who said this, and I definitely can't remember the quote verbatim,
okay.
But you'll get the gist of what I'm saying when I say that. When it came for my brother, no one stood up. When it came for my neighbor, no one stood up. But when it came for me, no one was there. No one was there to defend me. And that's pretty much what's going on now. We're being picked apart piece by piece, and as a result, you know, we have less of us as communities of color to stand up for each other when it's needed. And I'm done.
Thank you so much, Rob. I'm glad you joined us with that. And I'll turn to Jossie first, since this came out of the conversation we just had. And let me just say what you said. The quote you're talking about that you refer to is a very famous quote was by Niemöller, who is a Protestant. Martin Niemöller was a Protestant minister in Germany who at first supported the Nazis. And what he basically said was, and I'll just read it so you know people he's talking about. He was referring to this piece that Niemöller said, where he said, first they came for the communists. I didn't speak out because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the socialists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. Is the quote you're talking about. But, Jossie, would you like to respond to him?
Yeah, you know, one of the things is, Robert, I appreciate that. And, you know, there is that elephant in the room. And I see it slightly differently, but I understand what you're saying. And I wrote a previous article, and, you know, it was about what I call the great white default. And that is this assumption that there is a criminalization of any, specifically males of color, and that it's simply because I don't think it ascends to the level of racism, but I think what it is it's the default of white supremacy. And that sounds odd. How can you have white supremacy without having racism? And the reason why I say that is because, according to, it seems like, a consensus of scholars, critical race theorists of color, people of color cannot be racist, but we practice that same white supremacy. And so one of the examples I gave in this particular article is, and this is a true story, Mark, just give me, you know, quick 10 seconds, 15 seconds. When I was first started my very first jury trial, I came into the courtroom, as I used to do when in a basketball court, and I wanted to visualize my setting, where I was going to practice, where I was going to work. And I came in there and, you know, to check it out, to just visualize this. And I was dressed sharp, just like I would be in a jury trial. I had my hair up. I had no earrings in. I had my suit on. I was dressed to the nines. And about 15 minutes after I'm in there visualizing, meditating, I'm seeing my victory, this young lady comes in, and she sees me in the suit, and she sees, you know, and she walks in there, and she says, "Excuse me, sir, are you waiting for your attorney?" And right. and I don't think that was a racist statement. I don't think that was a racist notion on her behalf. I just think that she fell victim to, here is a big brown guy inside of a courtroom. He must be the subject of this criminal investigation. He must be the client. He can't possibly be the lawyer. And so I think that's a white supremacist notion, and I think that happens every single time we walk into a corner store, every single time we walk into, you know, we're walking around and late at night and, you know, past a particular, you know, club or bar or something like that. There's this notion that, and you know, just 5 more seconds, please. Jesse Jackson makes a statement where he says that the saddest thing to him is when he's walking down the street and he hears voices behind him, and he turns around and he sees that they're white, and he gets happy.
Right. That's white supremacy.
Yes.
Yeah, Mark, would you like to comment on that as well? Even though you weren't part of that earlier conversation, you might have some thoughts here, I'm sure.
Sure. Actually, I'd like to talk about something else Robert mentioned, and that's building coalitions across communities of color. There's this really great, unfortunate paradox that we tend to vote in presidential election years and then give up until the next presidential election year, when what the right wing has learned is that you have more power in off election cycles. And if we could gear up and get communities of color interested and excited and engaged in 2014, especially in primaries, but across the board, that's where you can influence elections in really dramatic ways with a small number of people. Indian country certainly shows that in places like Montana.
So I mean, I do want to kind of leap into Roma, the some of the issues I wanted to kind of bring out to the audiences here that they don't usually get a hold of, because we talked a lot about what happened in the Supreme Court in the last session. We did a lot of shows on that, on all the voting rights issues, gay rights issues. But there was a couple of things happened, I think, have flown on the radar, and I just want to get your thoughts on it and then let you raise whatever issues you think are relevant to this conversation. And that is, there was the adopted couple v. baby girl that really, come to me, when the press didn't cover it a lot, and it seemed to me to be, maybe I'm reading this wrong, but a very deep issue that abrogated the rights of Native people to not only define themselves, but to control their children. I mean, we may not have boarding schools anymore. We're not maybe Europeanizing the savage anymore in America, but in a overt way. But this kind of permeates American thinking. This was like, this case, I think, Mark Trahan, I think you've written about it as well. I mean, this is a very dangerous and powerful thing that just happened.
Well, yeah. I mean, what happened before the Indian Child Welfare Act passed in 1979 was the wholesale, for sale, private market for Indian babies. And what this case did, even though it didn't strike down the law, it brought back up that as a potent, that there is a market and it can be finagled, and young people can lose their child. I mean, it really boils down to that.
I mean, Joshie, when I see the picture of this father who is now just arrested by the federal authorities because he was trying to hide out with his daughter and not give her up. I mean, I you're a father. Or I guess we're all, I don't guess maybe all three of us are. I'm a father of three girls. And when I saw that picture of him holding his little girl and just his baby, and they're going to take the baby away from him to give to a white couple in South Carolina, I mean, my heart just fell apart.
Yeah. Well, you know, Mark, Snyder, not Trahan. let me real quickly greet Mark Trahan. Mark's one of my heroes. He's my big brother, and he's what the writer I want to be when I grow up.
He is an amazing writer. I'm glad you said that. Right.
because he actually deals with facts. I'm fortunate that I just get to deal with opinions and say what I feel. But you know, I actually take a different view on this case. And my view is slightly different. I think that it isn't such an assault on tribal sovereignty. I saw this as simply an adoption case. You know, the important thing for me as a father and also as a lawyer, that I see the cases leading up to the Indian Child Welfare Act, which was hugely needed, and they saw that as an emergency. It was an emergent situation that created that piece of legislation, was the forcible adoption, the forcible stealing of Indian children. And in this particular instance, I don't see a forcible adoption. I saw a father that at one time or another, perhaps he was in emergent circumstances and was infinitely more vulnerable than he is now, but consented to this adoption. And I put then in my father lens on, and I would never do that. I would never be in those circumstances, because there's no way in hell as a father that even for a second I'm going to consent to the adoption of my child. And so I don't see this as something that indicts the Indian Child Welfare Act. I see this as simply an adoption. And, you know, I understand the safeguards that were created mm-hmm. in the Indian Child Welfare Act, that, you know, to prevent the forcible adoption. But I see this as an opposite.
Interesting. Mark?
Basically, I agree. I don't think this case did address the larger issue. It was very narrow in its ruling and scope. And unfortunate for that father, but a good thing. One thing that's not part of the story in the mainstream media that I think is really critical is the question why Indian Country is fighting so hard on this one, particularly if it is a narrow ruling that doesn't strike down the Indian Child Welfare Act. And the reason is he's a warrior. He's a returned veteran. And in Native communities, that is a really high regard. And to have this happen to him, whether or not he signed it legitimately or through a ruse, while he was in a field of combat, that strikes a chord in people in ways that another case would not.
Absolutely.
That's interesting. Yeah. And I guess maybe when I saw it, I took it analytically a little too far, but I also kind of emotionally took it far just watching the scene.
You know, there's no I mean, it's an emotional scene, and it's an emotional scene. You know, there's a child now, you know, because all of us are fathers on this call. And as a parent, you know, that the notion of you being separated from your child is painful. I mean, it hurts. It physically hurts. And for me, you know, on either side, I think, you know, there's no good outcomes, unfortunately, for this child, because that they've developed bonds with both the adoptive parents as well as the biological father. And, you know, I wish there was some room for I wish there wasn't so much posturing on both sides as a human being. And this wasn't a sovereignty issue. People didn't see it as a political issue, but instead saw it as a human issue where we just want what's best for this kid. I don't know the answer. I don't know what's best for this kid, but I suspect it's someplace in the middle.
So there's something else. There are a couple of things I'd like to kind of raise some issues you'd like to raise as well. But let me throw one more out here for us to consider that I think also didn't hit the mainstream press, which I was – and I was talking to people around the country about this in places like – pardon me – in Rosebud and over in Wind River. And which has to do with sequestration and the effect it's had on native lands across the country. And I think most of them, we haven't covering this, but in many places around the country, because of the sequestration, housing, health, youth work, environmental oversight, police being cut to the bone on reservations across the country, Mark Trahant, this is something that's also flown under the radar that most people aren't aware of in this country.
Right. In fact, I blog about it regularly on Facebook, a page called Indian Country and Austerity. I think sequestration has to be looked at in a broader picture. And the broader picture is there is this real fascination around the world, but right now in America, with severe austerity. And the idea that suddenly if you cut everything, it's going to make the economy all well. And the historical facts are just the opposite. You cut yourself deeply when you do this. It's very destructive policy. And you look at Indian country, there is no private sector. So when you cut government, there's nothing to fall back on as an alternative. And so the consequences are much more severe. Some of the programs that are impacted are really basic stuff that prepare the next generation for the future. For example, because there's no smaller property tax base on most reservations, they get a fund for schools, what's called federal impact aid. And so when that program's hit, which is, again, through the automatic sequester, there is no alternative. And so school districts that need to educate kids, prepare them for the next generation of work, are being hit really hard in ways that impact direct education.
And so, I mean, and I think what I'm reading about, though, is that, and the effects have been pretty severe. I read that, you know, 90% of police officers, 50% of teachers in some places being laid off because they can't function.
And there's just no way, because there is no private sector, there is no alternative in terms of either taxation or creating new forms of revenue to pay for these programs.
So what then, I wonder, are the alternatives for the future? And I think the thing is, Jossie, because as a conversation I had with people the other day, saying, you know, look, I have a herd. This might sound silly, people living in the city, but it's not. I have a herd of cattle. I can't expand it because I can't get a loan because I don't really own my land, so the bank doesn't believe me, so I can't get money if you're living on a register to kind of build a business. It's like Native people in some ways are between a rock and a hard place in terms of trying to figure out what to create given the legal situation people are in.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and there's no greater voice, by the way, on sequestration. I feel, you know, kind of out of my pay grade on this conversation because Mark has been handling this.
Yes.
He was speaking about it well before, you know, really it was even a word within Indian country. But, you know, the truth is that there are certain legal hurdles, and the trust status of land is definitely one of those hurdles. And, you know, it's unfortunate because, you know, that results in lack of home ownership. That results in, you know, lack of business. You can't use it as equity for a particular loan, et cetera, et cetera. One of the big effects that you talked about ties into what we were talking about earlier, the Trayvon Martin instances and our lack of enforcement capacity within our reservation. We already have, you know, in particular areas, you know, for example, my tribe, the Blackfeet tribe, 1.7 million acres, and you have a very, very small police force to regulate that entire 1.7 million acres. And when you cut that budget even more, well, guess what? That so-called jurisdictional vacuum becomes more vacuumous. I don't know if that's a word, but that's what happens, is that it gets even worse. A bleak situation gets even bleaker as a result of these budget cuts. And then we have more Trayvon Martin. So these things kind of stack up upon each other.
So, Mark Trahan, I'm wondering, I think that, you know, part of the reason for one of these conversations in the air, at least from my perspective, is to broaden people's awareness of what's happening around America that we don't see, because the only time you read about this is if you want to read your piece or Josh's piece or someone else's piece, Huffington Post, or if you happen to be a reader of Indian Country Today. Otherwise, it gets lost. Nobody's talking about it in the broader society. So I'm curious your thoughts about the kind of, A, how to get those conversations started like we're trying to do here today, but B, what you think are the things that need to be talked about.
I think the thing that needs to be talked about, and really a great introduction for any of your listeners, I'll plug Jossie's book. Is his book is a great first read for someone anywhere across the country.
Don't know much about Indians. That book. It's a good book.
It's excellent.
Yes, it is.
Thank you very much.
It really boils down to this: the United States, through solemn documents, the Constitution calls them the supreme law of the land, made promises to tribes, and whether or not the nation can keep its word through thick and thin is the question. And these promises are not arduous. There are things that can be accomplished. And working with tribes can come up with solutions that I think will be better for everybody. I think when Indian Country prospers, it's really one that filters through the rest of society. And you see that with the tribes that do have some success. They hire their neighbors. They work with their neighbors. They create economies often in rural areas that serve everybody well.
And we also talked. We began part of this half hour with one of our callers calling in, talking about the need to build greater coalitions. And we only have about a few minutes left here. But many years ago, I was part of the Poor People's Campaign, and that was one place where, in 1968, where Native people, African Americans, Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, whites were together in one spot, in a movement, and that doesn't exist in America today. Something's got to take its place, it seems to me, Mark and Jossie, to kind of raise awareness that goes across our limited areas.
Yeah, you know, there's just and it's one of those things where, economic success, having, there was a lot of things that went into this seeming apathy, not just within Native community, but within a lot of our communities, this political apathy, this political lack of coalition building. And a lot of it has to do, in my mind, with some very, very specific intent regarding creating different legal structures within our communities that affects where somebody can perceive and literally say, well, that doesn't affect me. But the truth is that, as Mark pointed out, that most of these things do affect everybody. You know, the Trayvon Martin instance affects every single person, brown person in the United States. That does affect you. And whether or not you know it or not, it also affects every white person in the United States. They're every single day on a daily basis, you know, winning that white supremacy discussion and benefiting from that white default. Within, I'm sitting right now in front of the Fort Randall Casino. I stayed here last night. And nationwide, within Indian casinos, anecdotally, but empirically as well, this research is being done, that tribal casinos, who have been, in many instances, well, that's, that people have, the two words, tribal and casino, have been, a word, as a word association, become partners. They're forever coupled together. Those tribal casinos nationally employ about 75% non-Native. So within these rural areas, these places that oftentimes struggle with job creation, the vast winner out of that discussion becomes non-Natives. And so it seems to me that non-Native people have a vested interest, especially within these rural areas where tribes are located, in the increasing success and feasibility of tribal governments and tribal and tribal businesses, because we do contribute. And unfortunately, a lot of people, you know, that where the media is being made on the East Coast, for example, where you are, Mark,
right,
you know, that discussion isn't happening because there are very, very few federally recognized tribes out there.
And the media is also very East Coast centric.
Yes, absolutely.
So we're really out of time here today, but I want to appreciate the time both of you have taken. You just heard Jossie Ross's book, Don't Know Much About Indians, which you should read. A lawyer, an activist, on our program today, along with Mark Trahant, who is now the Atwood Journalism Chair at the University of Alaska Anchorage, author of books like The Last Great Battle of Indian Wars. He's a noted journalist and writer. We'll be linking to all of the web pages, their web pages, and their Facebook pages, and what they're doing on our page, steinershow.org. And Jossie Ross and Mark Trahant, thank you so much for your time. I look forward to continuing this conversation on the air with both of you.
Thank you. Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you both. And that's our show for today. We're going to go out with Max Roach Andrews once again, his song Garvey's Ghost. We want to wish you all to have a just lovely, wonderful weekend coming up. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineers are Andrea Melton. Our interns are Daniel Dupree, Alexander Rudy. Working today is Sinead Hawkins. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. You can go to our website, steinershow.org, and find out information about our guests, the work that they do, what they've been writing, link to their work. It'll all be there. You can also download our podcast and listen to our stuff on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.